Support from Community Blood Services of Illinois, the nonprofit agency providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. Donation information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Blood donation. It's about life.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from JBJ Gifts, Home Decor, and Collectibles, 723 South Neal, two blocks south of Green in Champaign. JBJ's offers Illini and other gift items, home decor items, and collectibles by manufacturers like Lennox, Yadro, Precious Moments, and Stife. More information is available online at jbjgifts.com.
Have you entered the WILL sweepstakes yet? There's still time to win, but you can't win if you don't enter. Don't miss your chance to bring home a widescreen, high-definition TV from Champaign Audio, a $1,000 gift certificate from Techline, an area rug from Sweeney Brothers Rug Gallery, or an AgriFab lawn vac. Entries must be postmarked by September 6th. To request an entry form, call 217-333-0850.
Welcome back to the second part of Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge, and glad to have you with us. Producing the program, Harriet Williamson, Travis Dansel, Jason Croft is at the controls. Tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we'll be talking about bullying in schools here in the United States. Our guest will be Dorothy Espelage. She's professor of educational psychology at the U of I and has written a book on the subject entitled Bullying in American Schools, A Sociological Perspective on Prevention and Intervention. Then in the second part of the program, we'll be talking about some of the legislation that's designed to provide some protection to whistleblowers, people who work for the government, and I think primarily here we're talking about the federal government, who are willing to stand up and say there's some kind of problem, something's wrong, there is wrongdoing, and yet that obviously can sometimes be extremely difficult for those folks. We'll be talking with Thomas Devine. He is associate director of something called the Government Accountability Project. That'll be tomorrow in the second part of the show. We are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon, and we have 10 different topics for you every week, and we welcome your questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking, broadly speaking, about how it is that sometimes people have mixed feelings about new technologies. And the one that we'll be talking about specifically this morning is electricity. Now, from our perspective today, as people who, generally speaking, are pretty much enthusiastic about new technologies, you might think that when electricity came along, people were very excited about it and would rush to have their home wired for electricity. But in fact, that is not the case. Decades after Edison invented the light bulb, there was still a relatively small percentage of American homes wired for electricity. Clearly, it made people a little uneasy. Interestingly enough, at the same time, there was great enthusiasm for the use of electricity as a medical treatment. And that's sort of the question that we'll consider this morning. Why is it that people had this odd reaction that they would be willing to subject themselves to electricity for health reasons or because they thought it had health benefits, but at the same time, the idea of having electric light in their house might make them a little bit queasy? That's some of the territory that we will explore as we talk with Linda Simon. She's professor of English at Skidmore College, which is in Saratoga Springs in New York, and she's authored a book on this, which is titled Dark Light, Electricity and Anxiety, From the Telegraph to the X-Ray. It's published by Harcourt, and it's out now. She has been a college professor for a number of years. She's taught at Emory and then also at Harvard before she went to Skidmore. She's also been a writer for some time and has written a number of biographies, including biographies of Alice B. Toklas, Thornton Wilder, and the psychologist and philosopher William James. As we talk with Linda Simon, questions are welcome. We'd welcome anybody's thoughts into the show. You want to join the conversation, that's fine. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Professor Simon, hello.
Good morning.
Thanks for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
I think some people might, given the, when they see what your background is and the fact that you're a professor of English and that you have done biographies of writers and people in the arts field and so forth, might think that it was a little unusual that you would take this interest in electricity, but in fact, you explain in the book that it was when you were working on the life of William James the philosopher, the psychologist, the brother of the writer, Henry James. That was when that you started to become interested in electricity. So what is the connection between William James and the history of electrification?
Well, William James was engaged in psychical research, and some of his colleagues in psychical research were actually physicists who were working on the issue and questions about electricity. What I noticed when I read their writings was that the language that they were using, for example, magnetism and animal magnetism and telepathy, was exactly like the language that was being used to discuss the power of electricity in common magazines and newspapers. And it seemed odd to me that spiritualism and the new technology would be using the same terms. And I was interested in the relationship between those two things. The other thing was that the connection between doing a history, a cultural history, and a biography is not really hugely disparate. I use biography as a way to really understand the historical moment, and that's what interests me with this book about electricity also. What did it feel like at the end of the 19th century to be confronted with this enormous power?
Mm-hmm. Well, then you go on to, and we can talk about this some more, and I made reference to it in introducing you in the subject, but you said as you explored this further, there were two surprising sorts of things that you found when you looked at people's attitudes toward electricity. One was, although we had electric companies that were out there, they were trying to develop a domestic market for electric power, people seemed to be very hesitant. And decades after the light bulb, the number of American homes that were wired for electricity was really still quite small.
That's right. And the resistance was related to the prevalence of electrotherapy. I think what I was very surprised about was just how mainstream this was. And when we're talking about electrotherapy, we're not at all talking about the convulsive therapy that became popular in the 20th century for really intractable mental illness. Electrotherapy in the 19th century was in the manner of massages and baths and infusions and sort of pleasant tickly sensations. People believed that this worked because they believed that the force that animated life, that coursed through the nerves, that really was energizing the human body, was in fact electricity. Not like electricity, but actually the same thing. And that, of course, made them fearful of artificial electricity. Because if your nerves contained this, then what would happen if you lit a bulb and that electricity could leak or emanate into the atmosphere of your home? I think it's a little bit like the fear that people have of microwaves, cell phones, and brain tumors. You know, there's the invisible energies, and we're not sure how it's going to affect our bodies.
Yeah. That I can see that is the way that you lay it out, although it still seems to be a little bit odd that people would, as I say, that and as you said, that people would be uneasy about turning on an electric light, and yet they would be willing to undergo some kind of medical treatment that might actually involve passing electrical current through themselves, mm-hmm. and yet somehow that would not make them uneasy, but having electricity in their home would. And I don't know if it has something to do with the fact that with medical treatment you have a doctor who's administering it, and perhaps you have some trust that they know what they're doing and they're not going to do anything to harm you, and that in the other case, you don't really know quite what's going on. It's mm-hmm. sort of more mysterious. You can't see it. There's nobody there to say, now this is going to be okay. Mm-hmm. But it does still seem sort of odd to me that the one would be fine and the other would make people so uneasy.
Well, it is very odd, but the 19th century was odd times. yes, the doctors, don't think about, you know, the medical profession in the 19th century. There was very little to offer patients. There were some rather what they called heroic measures in terms of drugs, but mostly you either got well or you didn't get well. And there was also a lot of competition for traditionally trained physicians. In other areas, homeopathy was very popular. Hydropathy, water treatment, was very popular. Hypnosis and mesmerism were popular. So patients could go other places, and physicians wanted patients to come to their offices. The battery sets that were really in every physician's office and every major hospital had an electrical unit presided over by a physician called an electrician. Those battery sets were quite beautiful and reassuring. They were made of wood. They had brass fittings. They were very professional looking, and the physicians exerted a great deal of authority to make patients believe that this would work, and physicians wanted to do just that. From a physician's point of view, it was a wonderful therapy because it required that the patient come back and back and back for treatments. So you might have a month, you know, once a week for a month, or once a week for 6 months. Well, this was lovely because you had patients coming to your office all the time. And handing them, you know, a prescription just for a one-time thing, that wasn't going to generate the traffic that physicians wanted. So there was a lot in it for physicians. There was, as I said, it wasn't for some. Let's say, sexual maladies, it might hurt a little bit more. But for most people, it was just a very pleasant, tingly sort of massage, and they felt cared for. The physician would attach the electrodes to the person's body. The physician would oversee the treatment. There was an interaction that felt soothing, and patients claimed they felt better. Now, who knows why that was, but they did claim that, and they kept it up for a very long time.
Let me introduce again our guest for this hour. Linda Simon is professor of English at Skidmore College. She's written biographies of Alice B. Toklas and also of William James, and has a new book that looks at how it is that people in the early years of electrification thought about electricity. And as we have discussed, it explores this interesting fact that on the one hand, there was a lot of enthusiasm both on the part of patients and physicians for the idea that electrotherapy could be beneficial to people's health. And at the same time, people were kind of nervous about having electricity in their home to do things like power electric lights. The book is titled Dark Light, and it's published by Harcourt. It's out now in the bookstore. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As you say, there are a couple of key ideas to keep in mind as one tries to understand what the mindset of people at this time was as far as electricity goes. One of them is the fact that a way of thinking, a set of ideas called vitalism, which is the idea that electricity was the source of life itself. And there, from there, you can understand that if that's what you believe, then the idea that you could use electricity as a therapy starts to become a little bit more reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
But from there, it's interesting to also to, as you make the point that, so not only did people think that a life force was essentially electricity, there also was the idea that things like the soul, the spirit, you know, whatever kind of word that you want to put on it, these things were also electrical in nature.
Yes, and the resistance to electricity and the prevalence of electrotherapy comes at a time of great heightened interest in spiritualism. So we have, William James was just one person, many, many people attending seances, undergoing mesmerism, trying to get messages through telepathy at this period, an enormous interest. And the idea that the spirit and the soul were electrical was prevalent. One doesn't read in the popular magazines anything negative about electrotherapy or vitalism or any of those issues. I mean, there was some question about charlatans in the spiritual movement. But you would read on the front page of every daily newspaper about accidental electrocutions and the perils, the potential perils or the real perils of electricity, and those caused enough anxiety for people to be really worried about it. One of the high points of anxiety was New York State's decision to use electricity to execute criminals. Mm-hmm. It happened in 1890, and the debate over that, which was centered, of course, in New York, but all over the world, That debate really generated, much worry. Because if electricity were being used to kill, then what were we doing wiring our houses with it?
That'll give us an opportunity to talk a little bit about Thomas Edison. Because as you also explain in the book, that you say that there's really two, this story that we've been talking about has two central characters. One who is who's a household name, and that's Tom Edison. And the other was a physician named George Beard, who probably a lot of people listening to us have not heard of. So we talk about George Beard in a moment. But let's talk about Edison. Mm-hmm. In as much as people, he is a familiar name, and people at least have the idea that he was a classic American inventor, iconic figure, boy genius, the man who invented the light bulb and the phonograph and a number of other things. But probably most people don't really have much of a sense of who Edison really was as a person, what his motivations were. What are some of the things that you think people should know about Edison that no one does, or that very few people do?
Well, I'm not sure, what people know or don't know, but Edison's motivation was to make money. He grew up in a rather poor family. He was very ambitious, and what he was ambitious mostly was making as much money as he possibly could, and saw the business world as his primary market. So Edison's idea of electrifying communities was to have dynamos, to sell the dynamos, to sell the generators, and to those generators would energize a very small neighborhood, and then there would be another generator. That's why he started a huge controversy with George Westinghouse, who had another idea, and that was to use alternating current, and that would be able to energize a much larger area. So Edison wanted to make money, and he saw the potential for electricity largely in the business world. He started out as a telegraph operator. He tinkered with telegraphy for a long time, continually improving the product, and also had his finger in every electrical pie that you could possibly imagine, really. He just, from manufacturing toys to phonographs to, just inventions that he had really not a clear idea of what the potential was, but it was possible, and that's what he did. And he was marvelous. All his papers are online at the Thomas Edison paper at Rutgers University, and they are just fascinating. You could spend your life reading them.
How did he think about electricity and what it was? I guess we sort of think, we're tempted to think of him as, again, sort of an iconic scientist figure, person of absolute logic and rationality.
Well, he was interested in the sort of non-rational side also. Oddly, he and George Beard collaborated on a project. Edison had discovered a kind of energy that he couldn't explain. It didn't seem to behave in ways that electricity behaved. And he got together with George Beard to do some experiments on life forms. They used frogs and to see how this force affected living matter. And then what they were both excited about was that it was some kind of almost supernatural force, and also that they had discovered an unknown force that would make them as famous as Newton or Galileo or, one of the really great big people in history. It came to nothing, and much later on, Edison realized that what he was really dealing with were radio waves.
It is interesting that on one hand to think about the, as I've laid it out, this idea that Edison was sort of the man of pure intellect and hard-nosed kind of logical individual, this stereotypical scientist figure, and yet I'm reminded of the fact that he was called the Wizard of Menlo Park. That tends to invoke this idea that something, that somehow what he was doing was magical, and that we do tend to think that science and magic are not the same sort of thing, and yet there was this air of magic about him.
Yes, And, you know, to call him a scientist is not exactly right. When he became more wealthy, when his laboratory became more extensive, he could hire people who actually were trained in science. But Edison was a tinkerer and an inventor, which is not to take away from his brilliance. You know, it's just astounding. But he really was not, he didn't have a firm grasp all the time on what he was dealing with in terms of science. But the idea of calling him a wizard, a scientist, a technician, reflected a kind of uneasiness in the culture. You know, wizards were not only magical, but somehow less corrupt than scientists who were seen by in the popular mind as possibly transgressing against nature, trying to find out too much, and that would come to a bad end. Or technicians, you know, people who were involved in new inventions, who in the popular mind were out to make money. And this sense of who could be trusted was one of the other components of generating some of this anxiety. There was a lot of hype in the press about electricity, a lot of controversy, and for regular people who didn't know what was going on, you know, who could be believed? Would you really become blind reading with a light bulb? I mean, that was one of the claims. Or could you trust Edison that this was going to be all right? And, of course, we're dealing with light bulbs of about 25 watts. They were so dim.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
if you You'd be lucky that you could read by
right.
them.
Yeah. And yet people found it very glaring. You know, the original, at the beginning, domestic lighting was considered very glaring and intrusive.
Mm-hmm.
Women didn't like it. They preferred how they looked with gaslight.
I do think it's interesting that somehow there's this idea that when you get to this question of who you're going to trust, they decided that the person who was more trustworthy was the entrepreneur, more trustworthy than the scientist.
Mm-hmm. It was a big problem. I think it still is a big problem. You know, when at the time I started this book, human cloning was very much in the news. And one of the refrains that you could read all the time was that we shouldn't play God. And I think there's a sense that science is too much able, willing, motivated to do that. We want too much power over nature, and that's going to come to a bad end. So when you read the fiction in the 19th century, scientists who were dabbling in electricity often came to a bad end. Often they were electrocuted. And it was only the pure of heart, you know, the people who saw that love and faith were more important, those people were allowed to survive.
Mm.
And that was, you know, I don't think that belief or that little shimmer in the air, I don't think that's really gone.
Well, I think that's probably an important idea, you know, when you look at this story, and that we might look at the reaction of people at this time to electrification and think, well, wasn't that naive, and isn't it silly that they would have those kinds of fears, and we're certainly above that now. But when you look at the way that now we react to new and emerging technologies, mm-hmm. it doesn't really look like our attitudes are that much different.
No. And nor does it look like the stresses are any different. But think about all the new technologies, genetically modified food, for example, or irradiated beef, or, you know, any of those things. We don't know really what to believe. And you can read pro and con on both issues and come out and still not know what to believe. So, no, I don't think we've come far. I think that knowing and pursuing is irresistible, and certainly, you know, this story doesn't tell us to stop doing that, but maybe it will help us understand our responses to it, which is often stressful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where George Beard comes in. If your listeners are familiar with him at all, it's probably as the inventor of neurasthenia. He invented the diagnosis of neurasthenia, which really was depression and anxiety caused by a lot of social and cultural stresses. And one of those stresses, which I think was very amazing that he could identify, was the press and the media and the sense of urgency we get about what's going on in the world, even things that don't necessarily affect us in terms of technology, the feeling that we should do something or know something or be able to respond in some way. And he saw this as a cause of what was ailing lots and lots of his patients.
We're at our midpoint, and I have a caller we'll get right to, and I'd also like to introduce again our guest, Linda Simon. She's a writer and a college professor. She's taught at Emory and at Harvard and now is at Skidmore, which is in Saratoga Springs, New York. She's professor of English. She's also authored a number of biographies, including books about Alice B. Toklas and Thornton Wilder and William James, and her most recent book, this book that we've been talking about here this morning, is titled Dark Light, Electricity and Anxiety, From the Telegraph to the X-Ray. That's the subtitle. It's published by Harcourt and is in bookstores now. Questions are welcome. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, where we are. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller here. The caller is in Crete, Illinois, and that's our line number 4. Hello.
Yes, this mm-hmm. is an age of women's diseases, of course, and Freud took advantage of this cycle of diseases of women in the late 19th and early 20th century, besides no hysteria, hysteria, etc. I was just wondering what this author thought of the book by Richard Moran called The Executioner's Current, and then I have a few questions on that basis.
Are you, Professor Simon, are mm-hmm. you familiar with the book?
Yes, I am. It's very interesting, and it's about, the first electrocution.
I was just wondering, isn't this a dangerous game to play by Edison to point out that this current is effective in killing people? Wasn't this perhaps a rebounding, in a sense, into his disadvantage?
Well, he wanted the current that was used for the criminal electrocution to be alternating current, and that was the current that Westinghouse was promoting. So the debate really became a debate between direct current, which Edison championed and which he hoped would be what people would accept, and alternating current, which he wanted people to reject. I would say that in the electrical community, you know, electricians, they were very much against criminal electrocution. Absolutely, because just as you say, they saw it as something that would be have a negative impact. But there were a lot of constituencies at the time, and the governor of New York, who set up this inquiry into another form of execution to substitute for hanging, was faced with different kinds of suggestions, which included the guillotine, lethal injection, which physicians opposed because they had just been introducing hypodermic syringes and they didn't want their patients to, you know, run the other way. Criminal electrocution came out on top, but it was not without controversy.
And today we find out that that's one of the more gruesome forms of execution.
Oh, they knew it then. The first electrocution in Auburn was absolutely horrible, absolutely horrible, and it was reported that way in the press. And yet, it went on. You know, it just went on after that.
There were many experiments with animals, too, and I remember in a classic documentary, there was this elephant, circus elephant, that Edison bought or hired, and we saw the graphic scene of the elephant being electrocuted. That's one thing that shocks people when they see it today, because we have a different attitude towards animals than we did then.
The testimony at the time was really quite graphic and really sickening. Physicians especially who witnessed it were just so repulsed.
So this is a new interpretation of Thomas Edison, no longer the MGM Spencer Tracy image, young American. Prophet of the future, but a man who was willing to do almost anything to make a buck.
Yes. In fact, he wanted, you know, there wasn't a word for electrocution, and one of the words that he proposed was to Westinghouse.
Yeah,
this was a business question, unfortunately.
He should have run.
No, I think for quite a while Edison's reputation as, you know, the Wizard of Menlo Park has been tarnished, but you can't take away from what really was a brilliant man.
He was very politically astute in many ways for that time. For a tinkerer to be that politically astute, to gamble with Westinghouse and pretty much win. Took a lot of brains, political sense of ability to say the right thing and do the right thing and create, most importantly, the right image.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Just to be real clear, so people understand this story, this episode that we're talking about here. Just and I hope people won't say yes. I get that. Just to go over it again. What we had here at the time was that within the electrical community, there were these there was some jockeying for position on how it is the electricity would be provided, either as alternating current and or as direct current. And as we explained, Edison was a direct current guy. Then you had the Westinghouse Corporation, and they were alternating current. And Edison wanted his way of doing it to prevail. And what he did, he apparently was involved in the idea of trying to promote electrocution as a method of execution, but electrocution using alternating current, because what he wanted to get across to people the idea that not that electricity per se was dangerous, but that this form of delivering it was dangerous as a way of boosting his own system, which was the direct current. Now, I don't know. I guess the caller right. raises the question, at the end of the day, did that simply end up making people uneasily overall about electricity, and did that benefit him or not?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, there's sort of no control group to know whether it benefited or not. I think Edison probably would have been just as happy if there were no criminal execution, but it seemed that this was rolling along. New York State had passed the law before they even had any knowledge of how much electricity would be required to kill someone. They didn't have a means of doing it. For example, an electric chair. They had nothing. But what they had immediately was a murderer. They arrested someone. He had killed his lover. They sentenced him to death by electrocution, and then they had to figure out how to do it. Interestingly, and one of the illustrations in my book is of the first electric chair, the person who suggested this form of criminal execution to the governor was a dentist. And the electric chair, of course, looks chillingly like a dental chair, and he helped to design it. But they had no idea what to do, whether to lay the person down, you know, on a table, or they just had no idea. And that was how it started. Edison became someone who testified in the hearings about this. And this is, you know, what he did with the opportunity, but it wasn't as if Edison went out to promote criminal execution.
Hmm. Back at the beginning of the program, we talked a little bit about this interesting thing that you came across when you started looking into how people thought about electrification, and that is that people had these two sets of ideas, that as far as having electricity in their home was concerned, that people were uneasy, and for the electric companies of the time, it was a tough sell, and was for a long time, to convince people to have their homes wired for electricity. At the same time, there was a lot of enthusiasm both on the part of physicians and on consumers for the idea of electrotherapies, that is, the idea that electricity could be used, it could be beneficial, it could be used as a medical therapy. What were some of the electrical therapies that were around at the time? What did physicians do, and in what way did they think that benefited their patients?
It depends what you're ailment was. And one of the medical books that promoted electrotherapy, Handbook for Physicians, listed, I think, 82 ailments for which electrotherapy was a positive kind of therapy. And that pretty much included everything, you know, from alcoholism to acne to writer's cramp to gynecological problems, you know, just across the board. So it really depended on what was wrong with you. Let's say you had some sort of respiratory bronchial kind of problem. You might have electrodes attached to your spine and the base of your neck and get some kind of infusion. And it was supposed to be an energizing sort of infusion. There were different kinds of treatments for different kinds of ailments. Sometimes you would need to be energized. Sometimes you would need to be relaxed or given something that was more of a sedative. And how long the treatments would ensue, how many would go on, where the electrodes would be attached, all would be calibrated to what was wrong with you. Gynecologists electrotherapy was very popular among gynecologists for a whole host of women's problems. And, you know, you can imagine what those problems were and why a kind of soothing massage might have helped. There was also the self-help movement in electrotherapy, which is kind of amusing. You could buy all kinds of things, electrical amulets, electrical corsets. Men could buy electrical belts for a whole number of ailments that you would just take this therapy into your own hands, even for children's teething problems. You know, you could attach some kind of electrical thing to them to make it soothing. And these were not harmful. You know, the infusion was not enough to cause a shock, but just a sort of tingling, massaging feeling, usually.
So
there were
to
also electrical baths, which just horrified me. I couldn't imagine what this was, but some research people who knew this, the electricity is actually sent through the water, but it's such an enormously low, little tiny bit that it wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't kill the person who was taking the bath, but you would believe that this would be a helpful infusion.
I've read about such things, and as you say, the idea to me is pretty scary, and one wonders how it is they managed to do this without killing anybody. But apparently, no. As far as you know, there was no one who was electrocuted as a result of having one of these therapeutic electrical baths?
No, I have never found any evidence of that. On the contrary, what I found was that physicians realized that when their batteries failed, the patient still said that they felt better. And therefore, physicians started using what they called the talking cure as a way of helping some of these ailments, and of course that led to psychoanalysis and psychotherapy. Once Freud, who used electrotherapy in his own practice, early in his practice, once Freud became more popular and more well-known, electrotherapy for a great many emotional, psychological ailments was just dropped. And by the end of World War One, or even earlier in the 20th century, the electrical units closed up. You know, it wasn't something that persisted in the light of much better therapies, which psychotherapy was one of them, but also the acceptance of germ theory, which at the period we're talking about was still a controversy.
We have some other callers to talk with. A couple of people listening in Chicago, starting with line 4 right here. Hello.
Good morning. I find this very interesting, and I was a little late, so I apologize if I ask a question that sounds familiar. But at Sing Sing, when they executed, I think over the period of a few years, of a century or whatever, they executed about 600 people. Was there a period of time where anything went wrong, where people would think, oh my gosh, we got to find some other way to do this?
I'm not familiar with the Sing Sing, you know, whatever happened there, because my book only covers the 1891, but at the beginning, things were going wrong all the time. The very first try went wrong horribly. So were people looking for another way to do it? Not necessarily. They were rather committed to the way they are doing it.
Well, you know, in Sing Sing, I think they used to do it every fourth Thursday at 11 o'clock. They used to call it Black Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very interesting that people like Lefty Buckhalter went there and his two associates. And they asked him what he wanted for dinner, and he told them, and they asked the two, and they said, we'll have what the boss is having. So you got some interesting, but I was wondering if that's why they went to the gas chamber and then lethal injection or whatever.
Could be.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Okay, line number 1 is next. This is also someone in Chicago. Hello.
Hi. I guess I have two questions at two opposite ends of the pole. The first is that was the use of electricity as a means of execution, did that lead to the use of electric torture during the First World War? And the second question is, the Christian Science religion uses a lot of that terminology of animal magnetism and mesmerism, mm-hmm. and I was wondering that did that make it at the time of Mrs. Baker a very new religion? Was it seen as a very avant-garde religion because of that?
Well, the language of electricity in terms of the spirit had really been going on for a very long time. So, no, I don't think that that Christian Science seemed to be allied with the new technology so much. In fact, I think that the language of the religion had an impact on how people were understanding the technology. So it sort of worked in the opposite direction.
Okay.
The idea of aligning Christian Science with the hypnotism, mesmerism, those movements also had been sort of coming to the fore over the course of the 19th century. As I said before, there was an enormous interest in spiritualism and what the nature of the soul was in terms of the matter of it, the content of it. And electricity was prominent among, you know, what people thought the soul was. Now, the first question, which was about electricity and electric torture, I just don't know the answer to.
Okay.
I think it's sort of inevitable that the idea of the harm that electricity could do, which was in everybody's mind for such a long time, could be transferred into any kind of torture.
I was sort of wondering if it was related to the treatments that people were getting, because quite often with incarcerated populations, it's very hard for the overseers not to sort of sink into sadism. And I was just wondering what.
Yes, well, one, you're right that to the extent that electricity was used in mental hospitals with very seriously deranged people at the time, that electrotherapy was often more punitive and more hurtful. Especially in terms of, you know, symptoms like excessive masturbation, let's say, electricity was designed to hurt so that it would sort of condition people to stop doing what was considered an antisocial activity. So I think you're right that for the incarcerated, powerless people who couldn't choose whether to get it or not, the treatment was often more painful than for people who were willing to go to the doctor again and again and again.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number two. This is Indiana. Hello.
Hello. In some ways, you might be able to use the old Hegelian zeitgeist. At the same time, the electrical fluids was often term used, is that in the medical field, in terms of over-the-counter medicine, what we would call now, they had cures, and basically they were alcohol with some kind of herb or tincture of some kind of dye in them, and they cured everything under the sun,
mm-hmm.
just like the electricity we're talking about. Then a little later on, when the Rontgen rays became a big thing, that was harmful because people could harm themselves. I have one of those quack... oh, I don't know if you want what you want to call it, a medical kit or something. Has different. What's good about it has different shaped hand-blown glass, and basically it's the same kind of apparatus that Rontgen used to show shadows of glass on the ends of drawn-out tubes,
mm-hmm.
and people would put that against themselves to cure themselves. It seems to be a general mindset. Now that I'm old, I'm 65. I've seen at least three periods sort of in the common press where these things all come back over a period of time. And they're sort of, you know, now they're in plastic, but they're the same sort of things using electricity or what have you,
mm-hmm.
cause some kind of cures.
Yeah.
And the other thing, I thought if you had the time, you could mention some other things. You mentioned that people thought that the light would cause you to go blind. I was wondering if there were any other kind of anecdotal information you could have about that, which now, you know, we would, you know, sort of ha-ha about that was occurring at that time. That's enough questions, I think.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, I think that's it. Maybe obviously you can comment on any of that you want, but maybe picking up on that last point to talk about what people thought were the potential hazards of having electricity in your home.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm very happy to answer that question. I'd just like to say one word about the X-rays as a form of therapy. When the first X-rays were out there, the use was not automatically clear. So although people were thrilled at the ability to see through the skin to the bones, the only use that came popped up immediately was that it would help physicians locate bullets in patients.
Mm.
And Therefore, x-rays started to be used for all kinds of irrelevant therapies, including for emotional and psychological illnesses, until news from the laboratory started coming out that, in fact, scientists' hair were falling out and people were dying of radiation poisoning, and that stopped very quickly. But this idea that any new technology can be used for any sort of irrational connection, that was definitely there with the x-ray. Now, in terms of other fears, people were afraid that artificial light, in other words, the length of the day changing because of artificial light, would significantly change just the nature of what was out there. So, for example, in one town that had electrified their sort of town square, farmers were concerned that the chickens would never sleep because it would always be daylight and they would die of exhaustion, or that their crops would grow so huge that they would be unable to harvest them. So this sense of tampering with actually what was going on in the outer world, this loss of control of what was going on in the natural world, that was one of the downsides. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I should say that maybe this last caller will remember is that for us, electricity is invisible and silent. You know, we turn on a light, we turn on a light switch, nothing really happens. But in the 19th century, the wires crackled. You could hear it. Often when you turned on a light, there would be sparks. So this wasn't invisible and silent. It was something that said something to you, you know, as it was coursing around in your house, and that frightened people.
Hmm. Let's talk with someone in Urbana, line number 3. Hello.
Hello. Yeah, the last caller almost anticipated what I was going to say. I'm in my early 60s. I'm an X-ray tech, and where I trained, we had a little museum, and that included the first X-ray machine that this hospital had purchased in 1921. And it was a beautiful piece of cabinetry with a marble slab top and beautiful brass fittings and everything. But we also had the instruction book still. And just like electricity, and as the prior people said, you know, it was promoted to cure headaches, acne, mm-hmm. you know, sore elbows, and these things. And, yeah, we did learn later that there were serious consequences to its use, although I can remember as a child in the 50s, you know, checking the fit of my shoes mm-hmm. in the shoe store mm-hmm. with a fluoroscopy unit. Mm-hmm. And there was in the Illinois State Railroad Museum, up near Belvedere, a streetcar, which was taken off the streets of Chicago in the mid-50s, and it has a sign up there advertising any part of your body x-rayed for $5 at, I think it was the Damon Avenue Clinic or something, you know, no doctor's prescription required. You just walk in and say, take a picture of my knee or my head or whatever. But, yeah, it was interesting that x-rays and electricity, you kind of followed this same thing of people initially thinking you use it for everything.
Mm-hmm. And people would have x-ray pictures taken of themselves and exchange them with family and lovers and friends because they were so enormously intimate.
Right.
The way that people go into little stalls in the mall and have ultrasound pictures of their fetuses taken. You know, when I read articles about that recently, I thought, well, I don't know.
I don't either. I don't either. But, you know, we just seem to latch on to everything.
Mm-hmm. No, x-rays were a sort of amusement park thing. You know, mm-hmm. you would have an x-ray exhibit, and you could, as you just said, go and have your x-rays taken, because think how thrilling it was.
Right.
Nobody had ever seen through skin and seen bones. I mean, that's... It was quite astounding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's still astounding, but we learned we have to try to keep down the side effects.
Right, mm-hmm. Wear those lead aprons.
Right.
Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
I am really intrigued, Professor Simon, by the idea that you would take an x-ray and and give it to a lover as a token of esteem. You say, here's my chest x-ray. My heart is in there somewhere.
That's right.
And it's all yours. I think that's a hilarious idea.
The very first x-ray photograph that was promoted in the magazines was of Röntgen's wife's hand. And you could see her wedding band on the... It was shadowy. I mean, one of the first terms for an x-ray photograph was a shadow graph. So you had this sort of shadowy picture of the bone with the ring on her finger. And there was something lyrical about it. It didn't seem clinical. It seemed intimate in a way that I can imagine that's how the 19th century responded to it.
Mm-hmm. There is such a picture. I guess it's not Röntgen's wife. It's somebody else's hand, but
yes.
You have such a picture here in the book, that same kind of thing, where the person put their hand down and you can see the shadow of the flesh and the muscle and whatever, and quite clearly you can see the bones. And then this person is wearing a ring,
mm-hmm.
and you can see that also, obviously, on the x-ray. Well, we're pretty much at the point we have to finish. And sort of last way to wrap this up, to bring it up to where we are now?
Well, I think the lesson is that we want to know and not to know. Hmm. You know, we want to know everything there is, and yet we want to be protected from the consequences of it. And that that's the essential tension. You know, I think it's always going to lead to anxiety in our culture.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time.
Oh, thank you.
I appreciate it. Our guest, Linda Simon, she's professor of English at Skidmore College, which is in Saratoga Springs, New York. And the book, if you'd like to read it, is titled Dark Light, Electricity and Anxiety, From the Telegraph to the X-Ray, and it's published by Harcourt. Programs here on AM 580 are made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone roundtables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. This show, Focus 580, also made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. That's where we'll leave it for this morning. We want you to stay tuned, though, because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll welcome back to the program writer Philip Graham. We'll talk with him this afternoon about poetry. Philip is a frequent guest on AM 580. He appears from time to time on Focus 580 and this program to talk about fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. We'll talk with him this afternoon about poetry. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. September wheat trading at 305.5, that down 0.5. December 318.25, down 0.75. September corn 226, down 2. December 234.75, down 2.25. March 242.75, down 2.25. December corn 257.25, down 3.25. September soybeans 618, that down 5.25. November 609, down 3.5.